Among the countries worst hit by the financial crisis in Europe, Spain. Construction fueled the Spanish economy for years, and the construction boom fed a demand for luxury goods, including purebred horses. That demand collapsed during the crisis, which has been perilous for many of those horses. Lauren Freyer traveled to horse country in the south of Spain, and she sent us this report.
Spanish horses once carried the conquistadors into battle in the Americas. Since then, they've been a choice breed for royal equestrians across Europe and for cowboys in Hollywood films. In the 1990s and early 2000s, Spanish construction barons began buying up horses, a status symbol for newly minted millionaires in Spain's heady boom years. José Manuel was one of them. 10 years ago, he bought a ranch in eastern Spain and started filling it with so-called PREs, Pura Raza Españolas, Spanish purebred horses. I found him in the classified ads. He's trying to sell his horses now.
Entiendo un poco de caballo, pero no soy experto, no.
I was never a horse expert. I just liked riding, he says. Everyone was buying up horses back then, but I don't ride anymore. I'm trying to sell them. For a fraction of what he paid. This horse, around 7 years ago, was worth $40,000, he says, but not anymore. Now it's worth less than half. In Spain, it can cost about $400 a month to house and feed a horse. José Manuel has five. He won't say what he'll do if he can't sell them. But last year, more than 70,000 Spanish horses were sent to slaughterhouses, more than twice the annual average before the economy here tanked. Concordia Marquez tries to save them.
Hola.
She runs a shelter in Andalusia, taking in horses that might otherwise end up in the food supply.
What we call the PREs, the pure Andalusian breed, it was for ages an expensive horse and very difficult to find. But the problem is that the owners, the good breeders, prefer to send those horses to the slaughterhouse than devaluate the price.
Concordia offers them another option. Donate the horses to her ranch, where she'll take care of them for free. The facility survives on donations. As we chat, Concordia strokes the nose of a recent rescue.
This is a PRE, and I found him abandoned. We adopt him here because he's got a problem in one of his hind legs. He's very beautiful. He's an stallion.
She describes where she found him, a massive ranch filled with animals, abandoned by its bankrupt owner.
When we arrived there that day with the police, we found all skeletons everywhere, horses, dogs, cats, ponies, I mean, everything, everywhere. It was, like, amazing. And he was surviving there with another group of 10, really skinny, really, really a bad situation. But we couldn't save the other, I think it was more than 50 or 60 that died there.
Driving across southern Spain, you can see horses grazing lazily next to the road. It's unclear who owns them.
They are completely alone. They don't have water, they don't have shelter if rains or is really sunny.
Virginia Solera García is Concordia's sister, who helps rescue those horses from the roadside. She says the economic crash has exposed a dark side to a longtime Spanish tradition of caring for horses.
But now, because of my experience, it's not about really love horses. It's because they want to have a horse because it's something luxury that you can show to your friends and say, hey, I have horses because I'm rich and I'm an important person.
The number of Spaniards who can still say that, though, has dwindled. And many of their horses are now here in this stable being cared for by these two sisters. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Andalusia, Spain.
NPR's business news starts with losses on Wall Street. Many banks are reporting their first quarter earnings this week, and the results have been mixed. Morgan Stanley had a good quarter. Profits are up 55%, but the news wasn't so good for many of its competitors. Goldman Sachs saw profits drop 11%. Bank of America turned in $250 million loss, and Citigroup says it will lay off as many as 300 stock and bond traders to cut costs. WNYC's Ilya Meretz reports that Wall Street, as we've known it, is shrinking.
You can see signs of it all over. Last fall, J.P. Morgan Chase sold a 60-story tower near the stock exchange. Dilip Brua has a fruit stand there.
I sold this one and I lost customers. Now, very slow.
So there's less people coming to you?
Less people.
It's part of a bigger trend. Banks are under pressure to cut costs due partly to new regulations. So they're shedding real estate and moving jobs to cheaper locations, like Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and Jacksonville. Improvements in technology mean it really is possible to do IT or human resources remotely. Even stock and bond traders may find their jobs are not safe, according to James Malik. He's a partner with Boston Consulting Group who helps banks outsource and downsize.
As trading goes electronic, as things that formerly were done voice to voice, now it's to computers, you no longer need those people to do those jobs because they're being replaced by machines.
20 years ago, New York claimed nearly 1 in 3 jobs in finance. Today, it's fewer than 2 in 10. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meretz in New York.
That UPS guy in the brown shorts delivering your packages? Turns out every minute counts. These days, the company is using technology to push its drivers to be more efficient, which of course increases profits, and that might teach other companies how to do the same. Here's Jacob Goldstein from our Planet Money team on a UPS truck in rural Pennsylvania.
The UPS guy, the brown truck, the barking dog.
I'd advise you not to get out of the truck here.
It all looks the same as it did when Bill Earl started driving for UPS about 20 years ago. But Earl says underneath the surface, his job has changed a lot. That thing you sign your name on when the UPS guy gives you a package, it used to be a piece of paper. Now it's a computer that tells Earl everything he needs to know.
Uh-oh. Beware of the animal.
The computer doesn't just give him advice. It gathers data all day long. Earl's truck is also full of sensors that record to the second when he buckles his seatbelt, when he closes the door behind him, when he starts the truck.
Technology means that no matter what kind of job you have, even if you're alone in a truck on an empty road, your company can now measure everything you do. In Bill Earl's case, those measurements go into a little black box at the back of his truck. At the end of the day, the data gets sent to Paramus, New Jersey, where computers crunch through the data from UPS trucks all around the country.
The data is about as important as the package for us.
This is Jack Levis. He's the guy at UPS in charge of this data. It's his job to think about small amounts of time and large amounts of money.
Just 1 minute per driver per day over the course of a year adds up to $14.5 million.
Levis's team figured out that opening a door with a key was slowing the drivers down. So Bill Earl was given a push-button key fob that attaches to his belt loop.
Is that high-tech or what?
The team figured out how to use sensors in the truck to predict when a part is about to break. And UPS solved a problem that Bill Earl and other drivers used to have. You'd get to the end of the day, and you'd find a package in the back of your truck that you should have delivered hours before.
You want to cry because you have to go back.
Now, a computer figures out the best way to load the truck in the morning and the best way to deliver packages all day. Bill Earl says a typical day for him used to be around 90 deliveries. Now, it's about 120. When you hear people talk about technology increasing workers' productivity, this is what they're talking about. Same guy, same truck, lots more deliveries. And in the long run, as the drivers have gotten more productive, their pay has gone up. UPS drivers today make about twice what they made in the mid-90s, when you include their wages and their health care and their pensions, according to the head of their union. But Earl says there is another side of driving around a truck full of sensors.
You know, it does feel like Big Brother.
Take, for example, backing up.
Back right up to their dock here.
For safety reasons, UPS doesn't like it when their drivers back up too much.
They know exactly how many times you back up and where you're backing up. And they also know the distance. They know how far you're backing and the speed that you're backing at.
And so do they ever say, hey, you're backing up too much? You're backing up too fast?
Every day. Every day they do, yes. You can't let it feel like it's an attack on your own personal, the way you've been doing the job. You can't look at it that way because you'll get so frustrated that you won't even want to do it anymore, you know.
Jack Levis, the UPS data guy, says the data are just a new way to figure out how to do things better and faster.
And he says the drivers benefit from that along with the company.
They're the highest paid in the business, which is why my job is to keep them productive so they remain the highest paid in the industry.
Still, issues over the data the company collects have become part of the bargaining process between the driver's union and the company. Under the driver's contract, the company cannot discipline drivers based solely on the data, and it can't collect data without telling them. This kind of back and forth about what kind of data companies can collect and what they can do with it isn't limited to UPS. It's going to start popping up for more and more workers at more and more companies. Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
This spring, we're joining our colleagues at NPR's Morning Edition to bring you stories that might help you navigate the higher education money maze. And today, we want to talk about veterans. There are a number of education programs to help military veterans pay for college. That includes the GI Bill. In fact, the government processed almost 1 million veterans' claims for education benefits in 2012. That's the most recent year we have available data. But the process can be pretty hard to sort through, and we wanted to hear more and get some advice. We have Michael Dakduk. He works on veterans affairs for the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities, and he's a former Marine as well. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
And also with us, Carrie Ann Grayson. She's a veteran of the U.S. Army and now a middle school teacher in San Antonio, Texas. Carrie Ann, welcome to you, too.
Thank you for having me.
You left the service in 2008, which is fairly recent, Carrie Ann. I wonder, to what extent is college on the minds of not just you, but your colleagues in the service?
I believe that we feel that we have to have college in order to get another job, further our education. I know I already had my undergraduate degree, so when I got out, I was not competitive with other people. A lot of people were getting out of the military, and so that was our next step. We had to either get another degree or another certification in order to become competitive with the other civilians.
So, Michael, there's a myth out there that if you serve, your college is paid for. It's not quite that comprehensive, is it?
Well, the most comprehensive benefit that folks are aware of these days is the post-9/11 GI Bill, but there's a whole host of other programs that exist, including a program that just expired on the 31st of last month, known as the Veterans Retraining Assistance Program, that provided 12 months of the Montgomery GI Bill, which is still in existence, to individuals aged 35 to 60 that are unemployed. That program's expired, but there's legislation right now that some folks would like to see move forward that would extend this program out. The Montgomery GI Bill is still in existence. And then you have disability programs like the Vocational Rehabilitation and Education Training Program, which is known as VR&E. And as a matter of fact, this past Veterans Day, the VA announced, the Department of Veterans Affairs announced, the 1 millionth beneficiary of the post-9/11 GI Bill. So you can expect that there's probably well over 1 million veterans using that benefit now.
Well, Carrie, let me bring this back to you. You thought you didn't qualify for the post-9/11 GI Bill, and I imagine there's many veterans out there who aren't entirely clear about what kind of benefits they can get and what they can't.
Correct. When I got out in 2008, since I used ROTC and I got my commission through using college, I did not think I qualified for the post-9/11. When I got out in 2008 with my disability rating, I thought I only qualified for the vocational rehabilitation program. My counselor told me that they were not going to use the voc rehab to pay for another degree. She had suggested that I try getting a job first using certifications. And it wasn't until I was done with my vocational rehab that she started talking about, hey, you may qualify for the post-9/11. Why don't you check it out? And then after I became a teacher after a year, I started looking into it more, and then I applied for the post-9/11 and my university, and then I got accepted.
And having read kind of some of the things you went through, it sounds like it was fairly common, in your experience at least, that people were either not fully informed about what was available to you, didn't know what forms you needed to fill out. You seem to have had trouble just kind of working your way through the paperwork.
I did. At my university, the office that they have is kind of hidden back. They tell you where it is, but when you show up, they may have workers that don't work for the Veterans Affair. They may be on a student work hour. And a lot of times when I would go and ask for assistance, they would tell me to call the 1-800 number, which, you know, a lot of veterans know we do have a hard time getting in that. Either you do get a hold of somebody, you don't, or the system is automated and it'll just hang up on you.
Michael, how common is that experience that she's talking about? Some of the bureaucracy, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. You don't know where to go to get help.
What What Carrie mentioned is something that many of my fellow veteran advocates and myself recognized over the past year or few years, and we worked on different initiatives to get more consumer education out to military veterans and service members. One of the big things that has been worked on over the past few years is the revamping of the Transition Assistance Program, which is now mandatory across all services. I'm by no means going to say that's a perfect program. Before, it was only mandatory for the Marines. The president referenced it as reverse boot camp, so making sure folks are educated on their benefits and what they are eligible for prior to removing the uniform. So that's absolutely paramount. There's been legislation that's floating around about making certain tracks. There's three optional tracks that service members can go down. One of those optional tracks is around education. Some more consumer education, counseling, and making sure that institutions are prepared
to
educate folks.
And let's examine that for just a little bit, because there's so many universities and colleges and different educational programs, and if every one of those institutions is responsible for understanding these bills and what's available and helping these veterans, you know, that's another problem. I mean, no matter how well educated and trained the vet is, if they have to go through the university, there's another stumbling block.
For military veterans, there's two bureaucracies they have to navigate when they make the transition. First, they're going to navigate the bureaucracy of the higher education institution, and that exists everywhere. The second bureaucracy is the Department of Veterans Affairs and getting their benefits. And you heard Carrie mention that when she was trying to call the 1-800 hotline or get in touch with veteran officials. That has been common, but there are a host of resources out there that allow veterans to get more access to information, including some revamped counseling programs that exist. That's something that myself and fellow veteran advocates have worked on to make sure that veterans are prepared and have the knowledge and resources to choose the best program for them, including the best benefit and the best institution that's fit for where they're at and the educational program they perhaps want to pursue. So it is complex. I think one of the things we have to be careful is we can't put this on the backs of one institution per se. Everybody plays a role.
Carrie Ann, what do you think about all this? There's one thing that would have really made it easier for you, the entire process of getting your education. What would it have been?
For me, it would have been a local resource center. Like, you know, I went to the university. They had the small school. There's a local university, Texas A&M San Antonio, that is building they're calling it the Patriots Casa. They're building a one-stop shop for veterans. If they want to apply to the university, the veteran can go to this building. They'll have services there. It's the first of its kind in Texas. And hopefully with, you know, a one-stop shop where I'm not having to go to, you know, downtown to the hospital or going to this veterans resource center, hopefully having something on a local university will help veterans kind of transition better.
So, Michael, she mentioned Texas A&M and San Antonio. Are there any other universities or colleges that are actually doing this right?
I think so. I think there's a whole host of them, and there's also best practices. I'll give you a few other examples. There's a career college in Virginia by the name of ECPI University, and they have a host of resources, including an employee that's directly focused on military and veterans affairs. He's a central resource, or as Carrie mentioned, kind of a local resource for information. We've seen an emergence across colleges and universities of veteran resource centers or veteran centers on campus. That's becoming one of the new best practices that we're seeing.
Kind of what Carrie Ann was talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are a couple of best practices. As a matter of fact, I'm publishing a white paper on this, on kind of the landscape of higher education and defining military-friendly and veteran-friendly. And I talk about some of the best practices and resources that are out there. Our association, APSCU, if you go to APSCU.org, has a best practices guide that talks about military and veteran best practices that you can implement. There are a few other groups like Operation College Promise and the American Council on Education that have veteran resource guides or veteran-friendly toolkits.
Carrie Ann, though, I assume that even for some vet out there that's frustrated with the process, you'd still say stick with it. It's worth it, right?
Definitely stick with it. Since I'm a teacher, you know, I believe in education and higher education. Now I believe that there's more resources than when I got out in 2008. And, you know, one of the best things is to network with other veterans. You know, I run a couple groups on Facebook and people will post, hey, you know, there's a job fair here. Oh, hey, this university will help. And so just, you know, networking, if you can't find that resource, just network with other veterans and get that support locally.
Carrie Ann Grayson, veteran of the U.S. Army, now a middle school teacher in San Antonio, where she joined us at member station KSTX. And Michael Dakduk is the Vice President of Military and Veterans Affairs for the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. You join me here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And remember, we hope you weigh in on this story on Twitter. It's hashtag Paying for College.